Hello and welcome to the Full of Beans podcast, hosted by myself, Hannah Hickenbotham. Throughout these podcast episodes, we will speak to a range of individuals about their experience of eating disorders, with the aim of increasing awareness and understanding whilst reducing stigma and isolation. Please note that the topics discussed in this podcast may be triggering for some individuals, so tread lightly, check in with yourself, and reflect on these conversations. In this week's podcast, I'm joined by Chelsea Roth and Catherine Cook-Catone. Chelsea Roth is the founder and director of Eat, Breathe, Thrive and has spent nearly a decade developing integrative health programs for mental health challenges, including a yoga for eating disorders program, now the core of a 7-week intervention. She also leads the largest study on yoga for eating disorders and serves as the UK operations director, the Give Back Yoga Foundation. Catherine Cook-Catone is a licensed psychologist and professor at SUNY Buffalo. She co-edits Eating Disorders, the Journal of Treatment and Prevention, and founded the non-profit Yogis in Service. Her research focuses on embodied self-regulation and psychosocial disorders, with over 85 publications to her name. Together, Chelsea and Catherine co-authored a study published in Frontiers in Psychiatry, revealing that over 60 individuals with eating disorders have been euthanized or assisted in suicide by physicians, often without exhausting evidence-based treatments. They have issued a joint statement opposing medically assisted suicide for eating disorders, urging the healthcare community and broader society to stand against this practice and support recovery. This episode was really difficult to record, and I won't lie, when we finished the episode I felt pretty heartbroken and had to take a lot of time to look after myself. So before you start this episode, I do just want to say that it's a difficult one to listen to, with the reality of how eating disorders are being supported with assisted suicide, but see it as a positive in that people are making a stand against this and people are doing something about it. I'm so grateful to Chelsea and Catherine for the work that they're doing and highlighting the unjust treatment that people are being provided for eating disorders. Eating disorders are not terminal illnesses and therefore should not be treated so. So take care, and I hope you enjoy this episode, because the research that they've done is really needed but equally upsetting. Thank you so much, Chelsea and Catherine, for joining me. I am really excited to chat to you. I feel like it's been a bit of a whirlwind organising this podcast. Like, your research, I think, came out last week or the week before, and I was like, I have to speak to these two people about what they've been up to. So thank you so much for joining me on the podcast. So I guess for the listeners, do you both just want to introduce yourself and maybe tell us a little bit about what you do?
I'm Catherine Cook-Catone. I am a professor at the University of Buffalo. I'm also a psychologist and a certified yoga therapist, among other things, equine therapist. My work really focuses on embodiment and how really working toward your embodiment is a pathway to healing. And then I research that. I use that in my practice, and it's my passion.
I'm Chelsea. Catherine and I kind of actually met through our shared interest in yoga and embodiment practices as a potential adjunct treatment to eating disorders or prevention to eating disorders. I come to this work as someone with lived experience of an eating disorder, a pretty difficult eating disorder that nearly took my life as a young person. And that led me, years and years later, well into recovery, to starting a nonprofit organization. We work as a charity here in the UK where I live, and that's called Eat, Breathe, Thrive. And our mission is to prevent and help people recover from eating disorders. And over the past 7-8 years, I've worked with Catherine on doing a lot of research. And my background, I did a lot of research in university, and sort of been studying. Yeah, generally, our focus has been on treatments and prevention interventions for eating disorders. This was a different project for both of us.
I mean, it sounds like you both bring, I guess you've got that shared passion, but different aspects in terms of, the psychiatry and the lived experience and the research. So it's really great that you've got that kind of diversity of perspectives. And I guess we'll dive straight in, because I don't want to waste time. I want to get to the nitty-gritty of the topic. So you both
recently put out a study looking at assisted dying for anorexia. I guess to start with, what was it that made you think, or what was it that sparked your interest in that, you know, this is something that we should do research on?
Well, you were the one who texted me.
So. I did. I think the text that I sent to you is this a legitimate journal? Where I sent Catherine a link to an article I stumbled on over a year ago now, and it was an article published, it's now kind of a famous article, that was proposing a new clinical category for what they called terminal anorexia. And I was alarmed by the study, and I was actually just, I really was, it wasn't like a tongue-in-cheek question. I was like, is this a legitimate academic journal? Because I was so surprised to see it. The study described three patients, two of whom were prescribed lethal medications on the basis that their eating disorder was terminal and unlikely to ever kind of get better. And I was both surprised to see it even sort of characterized that way. And I was concerned. I was really concerned as a person that had just having lived experience in that way. There was a huge outcry in the field. And so I didn't actually feel a need to do our own research at that time. I think we were watching it. Catherine and I were talking about maybe writing a piece together, a lived experience response. And it wasn't until we went to, we were kind of deep in writing that piece. And then we went to there was a professional conference earlier this year that we went to, and we both heard presentations from our colleagues on terminal anorexia. We heard presentations from other colleagues from other countries in the Netherlands, talking about the use of what they call in the Netherlands euthanasia in eating disorders. And I think it was the first moment that I realized it wasn't an isolated case. It wasn't one case. It was happening in multiple countries around the world. And I spoke to colleagues that were very on the fence about it and really were uncertain. And at that point, we'd done so much digging for this paper into the concepts that really underlie that this is a justification. So things like mental capacity, clinical staging and eating disorders, so stuff like severe and enduring eating disorder, severe and enduring anorexia. The notion that, for instance, when a person's had an illness for a long time, they're unlikely to recover. We've done so much digging on that that we felt there was a real need for clarity in the field because so many of those concepts are muddy. And in doing that, we decided, this research hasn't been done. There, no one has kind of gone through and gone, how many instances of euthanasia or assisted suicide or, made if you're in whatever you want to call it. There's a lot of terminology. That's part of the problem. It's hard to have a conversation.
Well, in part for, as we talked about it, our own ignorance on the topic became clear. Like it was hard to have, you might have your first gut reaction to hearing about it, especially I didn't say, but I also have lived experience with an eating disorder and am in recovery. And now as a psychologist, treat people with eating disorders, on a regular basis is part of what I do. So coming from that to this notion of, there's this also a, quote unquote treatment option of offering assisted dying. It was shocking. And then to get your head around, wait a minute, is this even legal? And then how is this legal? Like, I didn't know. My memories were of, I knew our country had been discussing and then legalizing assisted dying for people with severe physical illnesses where they were at end of life. And I knew about that, but this notion of assisted death for somebody with a mental illness and more specifically eating disorder was nothing short of shocking to me. And I just couldn't get my head around it.
Yeah, it's funny that you say that, actually, because before we came onto this podcast, I was saying to my partner, I was like, oh, I'm doing this podcast in a second, and this is what the topic is. And he was like, well, you know, you can't have assisted suicide. That's not possible for mental health conditions. And I Googled it, and it was like in, I can't remember which countries it was, but Netherlands was one of them, that it said since 2002.
One of the reasons we wanted to do this research study was not to go in and say, well, this is wrong and ha ha. That was, you know, here it is. We proved it. We wanted to understand what are the cases, how many cases have occurred, where did they occur, and what were the medical justifications that were used to grant these individuals access to euthanasia? And were those medical justifications based in our current understanding of eating disorders? Are they based in evidence and science? So we can get into theoretical and philosophical discussions around the nature of autonomy and whether some people would be, are never going to recover and all of that kind of stuff. But for me, I come at this from the lens of research and science. We create laws and enforce laws based on evidence, not that stuff. And so I think all of those are really important conversations to have. But what was surprising to me in this study is, you know, even regardless of all those conversations, is that there were, you know, we found 60 plus cases overall. We found massive gaps in reporting and oversight. So even in the countries like the Netherlands that do the best job of reporting, we couldn't look at 76% of the psychiatric cases. We could only get details about 24% of the psychiatric euthanasia cases. And that was the country with the best euthanasia reporting. In the United States, there is no reporting on psychiatric conditions at all. There were multiple states where a person with an eating disorder had been assisted in suicide, and there was no mention of that in the state reports. I had to actually go to the statistical agency that monitors it to get confirmation. And the only reason I knew about it is because someone published an academic paper about it. So there's huge gaps in oversight. And then in the cases, the few cases that we were able to identify, and I want to say that most of the data is in a black box that's not available to public scrutiny. The justifications that were used in those cases, I'm not talking about theoretical cases, I'm not talking about whether this could be appropriate for some, but in these 19 cases that we had details on, the clinical rationales that were used certainly do not align with best evidence and sometimes directly contradicted it. That is my concern. And I want to bring us back to earth, because that we're talking about these cases, we're talking about these laws. Of course, we can have big theoretical conversations, but in these cases, you know, a person, these were people that were characterized as treatment resistant, you know, which is not a, and because they were characterized as treatment resistant, you know, that was used as evidence to say that their condition was never going to be better. Those are really problematic concepts, not well defined or scientific concepts in our kind of understanding.
Well, and they would say that the request was not associated with mental illness. Well, in some cases, the person had been diagnosed with two or more mental illnesses, right? So, three or more. I know, I was trying to be conservative. I mean, I'm looking at one case in particular, just breaks my heart. It's case 2015-89 that we looked at. And this person had been diagnosed with anorexia, major depressive disorder, substance use disorder, and a personality disorder, NOS, and then was framed as treatment resistant and had not received the necessary treatments to even, you know, be supported in recovery. And then they were sure that it wasn't the mental illness that was leading to the request. And so Chelsea, you said this the other day when we were talking, but as you look at each rationale and you look at each case and you start looking at the legality and you start looking at the science behind it, like the justifications are like trying to hold sand in your hands and it just falls through your fingers. Like it just crumbled as we looked at them.
Firstly, I think I mean, I'm a bit speechless, I'm not going to lie. Like, I think reading what you guys published was, you know, like, whoa, I can't believe it. But then to hear it out loud, it kind of, I think, hits even harder. I mean, it's shocking. You know, I think there's, like you said, Chelsea, there's a big difference between, like, the assisted dying and there being a complete rationale behind that, you know, very intricate reporting and understanding of why that individual may want to do that and, you know, having that criteria in place. But I really can't understand, you know, you said there were so many cases where there weren't reports or it, you know, things weren't met in terms of, because I was listening to a podcast earlier this morning before we did this podcast, and it was talking about assisted dying for mental health conditions, and it was saying that, you know, in order to go through with the assisted dying, the clinician has to prove that every treatment avenue has been, you know, addressed and gone through, and therefore then that gives them grounds. But from what you're saying, it sounds like that's not the case at all.
The only country in which that is true, and it was recently made true, is Belgium. So they, I just kind of back up, and for those who are listening that maybe haven't read the article, it is a whopper of an article. It is long, but I really encourage you to read it, because I feel many people, we get caught in these discussions, but I'm like, just go read it, read about the cases, then let's have a discussion, just because it's information that changed how I think about this. When I started, I was very on the fence about it, and that information has changed how I think about this. But in the beginning of that article, one of the things Catherine and I wanted to do, and Catherine spoke to this early, is that we wanted to bring you on a journey with us to understanding how assisted, like in the countries where assisted dying is legal, how is it legal? Is it legal for people with terminal conditions? One thing that we learned that was very surprising to me is that in some countries, it's actually legal for minors. So you can be under 18.
I saw that you have to be an age of 12 in some countries.
It's legal. There's a protocol in the Netherlands called the Groningen Protocol for infants. So it's pretty expansive. So, and I'm not showing that for shock value. I have to assume that in these cases, these are very, very sick babies, but I'm just trying to give you a picture. There's a lot our field doesn't know about this. I think that just people haven't thought through. There's a big table in the article, but the major countries in the world that have legalized assisted suicide or euthanasia for people with mental illness are Switzerland, where it's been legal since 1943, and the only criteria really there is that you can't have the person doing it must not have selfish motives. It's legal for mental illness in the Netherlands, and it's legal for mental illness in Belgium and Luxembourg. Belgium, what you were just speaking to, is really the only country that I'm aware of that has recently put in place strong guidelines, not legally binding guidelines, but strong guidelines saying to psychiatrists, you need to ensure that a person with mental illness has experienced all types of evidence-based treatments before allowing them to do euthanasia. And what we've seen there is that slowed down the number of euthanasia cases, psychiatric euthanasia cases in the country. Luxembourg has legalized it, but there have been zero psychiatric cases, which, I mean, I celebrate their safeguarding. And the Netherlands, the way it is written, they say that the patient really must, there must be no reasonable alternative. And that's part of the issue with these laws, is things like terminal condition, mental capacity, reasonable alternative are very vague and in clinical practice open to interpretation. And that's a problem, because we've seen the ways that this is being interpreted has led to what I would say people being euthanized or assisted in suicide on bases that don't align with our medical understanding.
Well, in each one of those constructs, right, that are part of the legal rationale for, I guess, petitioning for, in some cases, an assisted dying for a patient, they each represent an area unique to each mental illness a body of research that needs to happen, right? So I can't universally say, okay, for all mental illness, here's the process for determining mental capacity. And eating disorders are particularly problematic because of the impact on your nutrition and your brain, right? So I can't take what would make sense for somebody with schizophrenia or somebody with major depressive disorder and just easily then apply it to eating disorders. So the science that needs to inform the safeguards still isn't there, especially for eating disorders. And we can't just shift what we know has worked for people who are using assisted dying in cancer over to apply it in this case. It doesn't, it's just wholly qualitatively different.
I mean I think that's a fundamental thing, isn't it? You know, looking at a physical compared to mental condition is, you know, I don't think that you could ever draw conclusions based on that. But equally, like you said, maybe from depression to anorexia, maybe even from anorexia to bulimia, like I think it needs to fundamentally needs to almost just be looking at the individual rather than maybe even the condition that they're struggling with. And I think one thing that I guess I'm perplexed by, and you might be able to help me understand a bit more, is this idea of terminal anorexia. And because as somebody that I also have lived experience of anorexia, and this time last year would say I was probably the illest I've ever been in my life, at that point, if you'd have offered me something like this, can't say for certain, but I've definitely had moments where I thought, yeah, that's the option I would take rather than going through recovery. Now, in the place where I am in terms of having gone through recovery and done that intensely difficult work, I'm so grateful that that wasn't the case. And I guess, you know, you can't kind of say that that's going to be the case for everybody. Everybody's in a different situation. But based on, I guess, just my personal experience, I can't understand how a term such as terminal anorexia could be given, because it's, to me, it's not a terminal illness that there's no chance of recovery from.
Yeah. No, it makes me think kind of one of the surprising things that we learned in this study, and it was really counter to what we expected, because we went into these cases and everyone that had a descriptive case report, we coded line by line every single sentence in that to try to identify, was the clinician saying that this person's eating disorder was terminal? Was the clinician saying that this person had an incurable form of their illness? So that's what we were coding. And what surprised us, in only 11% of the cases framed the eating disorder as terminal. And 100% of those 11% were in the United States, where assisted dying is only legal for terminal conditions. So what we saw is, in each country where assisted dying is legal, you would see the eating disorder, like the assessor frame the eating disorder in a way that met those legal criteria. So in the Netherlands and Belgium, where most of the cases we reviewed were, there was no mention of the eating disorder being a terminal condition. They didn't frame it as a terminal condition, presumably because it is not one, but also because they weren't trying to squeeze an eating disorder in through the legal eligibility criteria. And what I know there's been a lot of focus on the term terminal anorexia. I think it's been really good to push back on that, because we can't just invent new labels, diagnostic labels, out of nowhere. They have to align with the science. And what surprised me is that in many countries of the world, they're still euthanizing people with eating disorders without that label. So I'm like, yes, that label is a problem. But also what is a problem is the framing of an eating disorder as an irremediable condition, or the assumption, this was the big one for me, that because the person has had their illness for a long time, they're unlikely to get better. We do not have that research. We cannot say that duration of illness, like a person's had an eating disorder for 10 years, thus they will not get better. That is so far from science. In fact, the longer you follow people with eating disorders, if you follow them for 20 years, way more people get better. So it's a That was my concern, is that it, you know, there's almost a distraction with the terminal anorexia thing, because it's anywhere this is legal right now, we're seeing a kind of sliding of eating disorders into the eligibility criteria. And that, for me, what concerns me is that it does not align with the science, and that, and the result of it is the end of someone's life. And yeah, we can't lose sight of that.
So our journey really took us, we were very, I would say, like, reluctant travelers. So first of all, we're like, let's just write a lived experience piece and just say our concerns. So we're just, you know, something not, you know, not light would be inaccurate, but like a serious look at this from the lens of two people that have recovered. And then, like Chelsea said, then we're like, oh, well, let's do a literature review, because this is confusing. And like, what's the law and what's happening? And maybe we just did a really nice literature review that everybody could see how the law is kind of shaping practice instead of science shaping practice, right? And then we're digging in, and then Chelsea, she's like, you know, there are these case studies. There's case studies. And I'm like, no.
And they're all in Dutch.
Oh my God. Then we said, well, if we're going to see that, we got to look for all the case studies. So now we have like the librarians at my university are helping us with a worldwide search for all published case studies. So this got so big this last semester, there were times that, I mean, I don't know if we were sleeping well, just and going through each of the cases, just the, like, I had to keep reminding myself they're dead. Like, I kept trying to come up with treatment plans, and then my brain was fighting the notion. It was a lot to really, really feel this from the person up. And what we need is access to the data in this way, so researchers can sort this out, right? So everything's getting informed. We're squeezing cases into law terminology instead of looking at cases and seeing, do people have access to care? Do people have mental capacity? Do people recover? Oh, have we studied enough about the recovery of eating disorders? We have an RCT coming out on Chelsea's program. We moved people from like clinical to non-clinical across a variety of areas. And many of the people, how many people in the study were like 10 years into their eating disorder?
It was the vast majority of people had 10 plus years. I don't remember the exact number.
Yeah. So that was just, and that's an embodied. So we're not even doing embodiment work, right? A lot of the treatment is focused on cognitive approaches, family-based, which are all good. It's all good, but there's more, right? It can be even more, even broader what we're doing for treatment. And so, yeah. No.
Just add one more thing to this, which is, we hope that we were able to put down in this paper enough information for you to be able to read it and make your own decision. And my fear is actually that we haven't done a good enough job of that, because of course we can't take every one of those case studies and put it down and have you read it. And we've tried to, but I think, you know, we've launched this big campaign, Treatable Not Terminal, and tried to raise awareness about this. And I've gotten to have lots of conversations with people. And for the most part, it's been very positive. And I've noticed where people have reservations is they can think of these exceptional circumstances. So they think of that one case where they go, oh, I don't know though, you know, this person was so, so sick. And what about multiple organ failure? And what about a GI rupture? And what I would say to that is, we can probably always think of exceedingly rare cases. But what I want to invite you to do is look at these cases. Look at these cases that we read, because they were not those exceedingly rare cases. I didn't see those exceedingly rare cases in our data. I saw somebody between the ages of 18 and 30, and usually it says between the ages of 20 and 30. So when they say the age of 18 and 30, I have to wonder if that person was 18 or 19. Who had a diagnosis, multiple diagnoses, one of which was an eating disorder and one of which was autism, who was in the case report, they said, we didn't do psychological therapy because this patient lacks mentalizing capacity. And they said, this patient has had a chronic eating disorder, and we're talking about a very young patient, and will never get better. And I'm going, how can you say that? How can you say that with any degree of certainty based on the research I've read? How can you say that? So those, I would just say, of course, we can think of those exceedingly rare cases, but we're talking about these cases. And I'm not seeing those exceedingly rare cases in our data. I'm seeing young patients, a third of them were under the age of 30. The second third were between the age of 30 and 40.
64% under the age of 40.
Of course, they're exceedingly rare cases. And it's why I think palliative care is really important. But I think sometimes we can get lost in that theoretical land of what if, or is there in these individual cases. But here, I think we're talking about a public safety issue. We're talking about patients that were not those exceedingly rare cases that were prescribed aid in dying. And I not in a way that aligns with medical understanding. So that's the conversation I hope our field has.
And I think as well that from my perspective, I'm not a medical professional, but from my perspective, exploring the idea of palliative care compared to assisted dying is quite a significant difference, because one, you know, is that sort of end of life care compared to lethally injecting somebody when, you know, it's maybe not their time. And I think that's the thing that gets me, is there may be, like you said, those really rare cases where people are like so medically unstable, but I still can't see where, I don't know how to word this, but it's almost, basically, the example I'm thinking of, and this is kind of off topic, but it's the only way that I can think is to use an example. But so, like, when you think about something like death row, you can never 100% certainly that somebody committed a crime. Therefore, you know, there's that teeny weeny percentage that you could get it wrong. Therefore, you know, a lot of people don't believe death row is something that should be in place. And that's kind of what I'm saying here, is that you cannot 100% say that somebody is definitely terminal with anorexia. Therefore, is it worth taking that risk? I guess I don't know whether risk is the right word, but is it worth that chance, losing that chance that they could potentially go on to survive? I think that's the thing that I'm like, I can't see that there would ever be 100% certainty to say this is exactly the case, therefore we believe that, you know, lethally injecting somebody and then them dying is the best option here.
Yeah. I would also say the trust that we are putting into a healthcare system that has so many perverse incentives to be. One thing I've said to a few people is, you know, I feel like we get into these, so Kath and I have kind of been surprised, because we're like, oh, we don't think of this as a partisan issue. We don't think of this as a political issue, but somehow we seem to, kind of, it becomes a thing about individual rights over public safety, and there's all of this conversation. But one thing I've said is, you know, it's, these laws actually grant a whole lot more power to physicians and healthcare providers than they do to patients. They give legal protections to physicians who are making a judgment about whether this person is likely to recover or has a terminal illness. They actually give far more rights to physicians. I don't know that the science is there that I want my healthcare provider deciding whether or not my eating disorder is terminal. I worry about healthcare providers who think that that science is there and think that they can make that decision with confidence. I worry a lot about that.
There's very little training on eating disorders in medical school at all, right? And then, who are the doctors that are making the decisions, and what is their background? What's their experience? Are they continuing to stay updated in the research? Do they have, right? So at a certain point, it's all, it just becomes so dissociated from the facts and the training and the science and the people. And we saw that clearly in the mismatch between what we know, what we tried to do in our article is juxtapose what is happening in practice with the law on one side and what's happening in practice with the research on the other. And it doesn't line up. It just doesn't line up.
And something I wanted to ask earlier, actually, that I then I think we moved on to something else, but we kind of come back to it. You mentioned about, you know, giving the physicians a lot more power. And I think that's a really great point that you've made, Catherine, about the fact that there's so little training for physicians that work in eating disorders. So it then even it begs the question even more of like, how can we with certainty know this? Because people aren't even trained appropriately to treat somebody, let alone make this decision. Mm-hmm. But you kind of, you know, what you're talking about at the start with the lack of reporting and people making these decisions. When you were doing your research, I know obviously you focused a lot on like the facts and things like that, but did anything come up in terms of what the motivations might be for a clinician to actually, you know, say this is probably the right idea for my patient?
Yeah, that's a good question. That's a great question. I guess I want to just also say I don't want to in any way demonize clinicians or physicians here. So I want to be careful. We're talking about a specific set of cases, and there's so many, you know, potentially physicians listening to this going, I have plenty of knowledge. I keep up with my training.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, we want to keep everyone on side. It's the few rather than the many.
Yeah, and what was striking to me, I think I just mentioned, is that in 42% of the cases we reviewed, previous physicians who had known and worked with these patients for a long time, sometimes their GP, sometimes their psychiatrist, had actually declined, had refused their request for euthanasia. So in Switzerland and in the Netherlands, they actually have euthanasia centers that you can go to. And so that may be, in some cases, these were psychiatrists or consultants that were evaluating this person for the very first time. So they're not seeing them when they're healthy. They don't have a long relationship and have a sense of what this person's thinking is like before they're severely malnourished. I think it was 64% were malnourished or underweight at, my sense is that because the majority of the cases we were looking at were in, the Netherlands, these cases were written in a way to kind of explain to the public why this was a justified case. So you don't really get a great sense of the physician's thinking other than them really hammering multiple times that this person has an incurable condition, that they are without prospect of improvement, which that must have been in almost every case we read, that they're dealing with unbearable suffering. So you don't really get a window into their head because it's written in that way to align with the legal kind of framework. I have no doubt that the physicians that are doing this believe that it's the right thing. I have no doubt. I don't think I don't think really of evil people in the world. I'm sure they believe it's the right thing. I'm sure they believe this is a person that is suffering and that will never get better, and that they're asking, and it's the best thing to do is to respect their autonomy. And I think part of what we're trying to do is share some information so that we can be making, so that even the physicians that are doing this might be able to kind of consider what they don't know. Consider the things they don't know. Consider where where there's how much uncertainty is involved in this practice. But I don't think they're bad people.
Like, to build off of what Chelsea's saying, so if let's say that one of the solutions we have, which has happened in some jurisdictions, is we have centers that then do this work. So it's not the person's own physician, it's not their eating disorder treating physician, but they go to another location. That would require those physicians or treating professionals that have the license to do this to have to be up to date on the research in every single field, including eating disorders. And while I'm not an expert in all of the fields, I can tell you for sure for eating disorders, there we have a long history of misinformation. The reason that I started sharing that I was recovered from an eating disorder is because patient after patient after patient that came to my office didn't believe that anyone recovered. And so I wrote a blog and I shared, and I was very inspired by Marsha Linehan, who wrote an op-ed in the New York Times. And I said, you know what, I'm just going to tell people, even though I'm a professor, and at the time it wasn't popular to do this, I said, I'm going to tell people that I'm recovered from an eating disorder and that it can happen, that you can be fully recovered and not struggle every day with every meal. Just it becomes that it's not part of who you are anymore. And we have such misinformation in our field to I really think, leapfrog to where we're talking about assisted dying with all this misinformation and people really going with the folklore around it instead of the science and believing they're informed when they haven't been trained or they're not in like up to date in the research is really, really scary and concerning for me.
This was something I was going to say earlier, is that so many people that have an eating disorder believe that they can't recover. And I think not only people that have an eating disorder believe that they can't recover, but I think there's a big stigma in society that, you know, once you have an eating disorder, you've got that for life. Like, you can't live a life where you're not consumed by thoughts about food or your body. And I know that a lot of parents and carers that I've worked with will say, I'm so terrified about my child or my loved one having an eating disorder because I know now that they're never going to get better. And I don't think that there's a way of them getting better. So then to give this sort of confirmation that there are people out there that can struggle with an eating disorder that won't ever get better, I think is really, really scary. And I think that, you know, it's not just people with experience of eating disorders, but there's a stigma in society that you can't get better. And like you said, Catherine, you know, people that maybe aren't specialist eating disorder clinicians, they may also believe that there's no chance of getting better. So unfortunately, this terminology and this kind of information coming out that people are going through assisted dying because they've got a terminal condition, it just builds on this narrative that eating disorders aren't something that you can get better from. Whereas, you know, we're living proof that you can recover. And I think that's something that's so important as well, is that recovery will look different for everybody. So for some people, it may be that they reach full recovery and they never have, you know, a disordered thought again, and they can live their life totally free. For other people, there may be lapses and they may lean back into their eating disorder when things got hard, but they know how to navigate back out of it. And I think it just, all of that together just shows how individualized this is. So to literally be giving kind of these diagnoses or this understanding that it is something that should be provided assisted dying, or, you know, so black and white, it's very much, eating disorders are so complex and so individualized. Just, you can't be that specific, yeah. I don't think.
Yeah, and I want to bring you to just give you a couple, I keep bringing us back to this data because I think it helps us, but it illustrates some of your points. There's some quotes we have from these cases, and these are quotes from the case reports themselves. And just to give you an example of how patients were framed as having untreatable conditions, and, you know, we have to, in some cases, this was told to their family and to the patient themselves. So that's, I have to wonder if that is subtly coercive, even if it's not intentional for that physician to be being coercive. Even these narratives in, you can't take an individual out of their society and out of their community. So even these narratives we have that you've both spoken to are in some ways coercive. You know, if you don't feel like you can ever get better, then why, what's worth trying for? And I know that, but just to give you a couple quotes, this one says, even though the psychiatrist noted that there were no realistic treatment options specifically aimed at curing the depressive disorder, eating disorder, the psychiatrist gave a couple pieces of advice to possibly improve the quality of treatment, but their chance of recovery was estimated as small, and it was disproportionate to the great burden on the patient. This one says, treatment aimed at autism spectrum disorder was not used because that was not the biggest problem, and because autism cannot be treated in a therapeutic sense. This one says, this is so rough. This one says, the patient felt trapped between her eating rituals and untreatable gloominess. Untreatable gloominess. This one says, the physician was convinced that the suffering for the patient was unbearable and, according to prevailing medical insight, without prospect of improvement. So you see over and over again. I mean, that's why I say, just read the cases before commenting on it, because that's what we're responding to. Mm-hmm. We're responding to really like very strong language that, you know, a strong claim requires strong evidence. Mm-hmm. So if you're going to say that the person is untreatably gloomy, show me the study. You know, I would love to see that study. I'm sorry, I shouldn't laugh because we're talking about dark, but it's remarkable that those claims were couched in medical language, because that does not sound like medical language to me.
No, and I completely agree with you. You know, you're not laughing because of what's it, you're laughing because of the like uncomprehendable thing.
Yes.
That this is actually happening. And you know,
it's
people's lives. And I think you're so right. You know, if you're going to do something and use such extreme language, then you need to have extreme proof and extreme evidence behind that. So gloominess is not really something that I would think that would.
I mean, I have to assume we had a translator who's a clinician, and I'm gonna mention that these are translated from one language to another, and so we went through three iterations of translation and then, you know, triple checked. So that is coming from a Dutch case, but still we're still talking about you know, I mean, I can give you one from a US case here, and this language, I just couldn't. It says these are suffering from unrelenting and irredeemable disorders. These patients make difficult choices, ultimately deciding enough is enough. We cannot describe eating disorders as irredeemable. There is nothing scientific about that. And to see it used to justify someone's death breaks my heart. It makes me, it upsets me. It really does. Cause that's someone's sister, that is someone's friend, that is someone's daughter. And I, you know, this is not my scientific lens, but some of that language is sounds like it is rooted in stigma rather than science.
I'm interested. You mentioned the age ranges of people that had gone through the assisted dying. Did you look into things like gender or ethnicity or anything like that? Was there any sort of disparity there?
Well, we can have you guess. Of the cases that we analyzed, guess how many were reported as female? Guess what percentage?
From the smirks on your faces when I ask the question, I'm going to guess pretty high.
100% female.
100%. 100%.
Wow.
So we want to think about too, I mean, and Chelsea and I have talked a lot about this, just in terms of what's the best way. And so, you know, there are the data, and then there are the concepts, and then there are the data, and kind of moving back and forth between the two. And it's interesting because earlier this morning, I'm like data, and now I'm like all concepts right now. But that said, what about like internalized misogyny? Like, and what about internalized notions of the treatability of eating disorders? Like, we're very conditioned to think these things are true, right? I don't know the gender of the physicians. I don't know the gender of all the cases that we didn't have access to. But the ones that we did were 100% female, and we don't have any information on race or ethnicity. So this is all part of what we need to be able to see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I would also add that determining a prognosis for any type of chronic condition, determining a prognosis for someone with cancer is very difficult, and physicians tend to be very inaccurate, even with something like cancer. Mm-hmm. When you try to determine a prognosis of a psychiatric condition, not only are physicians often inaccurate, and we don't have an empirical basis to be determining that, but there's also been studies that have shown that the physician's own beliefs, their biases, their personality, and their values affect the way they make those judgments. So I come back to this. This is my concern. This is a, you've pointed it out, Hannah. This is like the highest kind of consequence kind of decision. If we get this decision wrong, we possibly end the life of someone who could have as full of a life as you and I. Like you're in recovery. I would have definitely taken this. I asked my doctors to just let me die. I was definitely in that point, and I have such a full, beautiful life. Like when the consequences are so high, we have to be really sure that our bias isn't affecting it, that there aren't other possibilities. And that to me is, again, what really worries me about this is that evidence is not there. And the consequences of a mistake is, you know, potentially someone like you, like Catherine, like all, we've got to humanize this. These are human beings who are in the darkest moments of their life. And I think that we need to be really careful about how we're responding to someone's verbal wishes in those dark moments, knowing that in my dark moments, what I was saying out loud is something that I look back and I'm so grateful they didn't listen.
Well, and I think that something also you said, Hannah, really struck me was that you said the idea that this can happen has implications for the validity of the notion of eating disorders aren't treatable. So they must not be treatable if we're allowing people to have assisted dying for it, right? So somehow this legal decision or well, not quite even here in the United States, but that this is happening means it's proof that it's not, you can't get better. And in fact, those two things are not even connected. That's what we were trying to say in the paper, is there isn't a straight line from here to there. And what'll be really scary is if the science isn't out there and people are going like, see, I can't go backwards to where I was sick, but I can imagine what that would feel like in a body of someone really sick to go, oh, now, oh, also you can have assisted dying. That shows me how hopeless my condition really is.
Yeah. And I think to put it, you know, bluntly, again, speaking from personal experience, the end goal with my anorexia was to die. So somebody almost is giving you that kind of last little ego, you know, it's that last little push that you need to get you over the line. And I think that's the thing that kind of upsets me the most, is it's almost validating. It's almost coming alongside the eating disorder and saying, yeah, we can get you over the line now for that last little bit. And I think you're so right in terms of, you know, making it, you know, it sounds harsh to say that sort of thing, but, you know, saying it could have been me, it could have been you, it could have been your friend, like what have you, we have to make this personal because it is really something that needs to hit emotionally to get that message across of how severe it is.
Well, Hannah, 58% of these cases had suicidal thoughts, 37% had multiple suicide attempts. So you're not alone. Yeah.
Yeah, it was interesting too to see in the cases the assessors writing up the case would say in one sentence this person had repeatedly attempted suicide, and then in the very next sentence say, but their wish to die is not a symptom of mental illness. Just like how are you making that on what basis have you come to that? You have just said that the person has attempted suicide, feels suicidal, but their wish to die is not an expression of mental illness. So that's a really interesting, I don't know how that point was made. The other thing that just came up for me as you're speaking is I've noticed sometimes it's helpful to look at contradictions just to better understand how we're thinking about things. And you know, this is an extreme one, and because it's an extreme contradiction, you know, it will lose some of the nuance, but bear with me, you know, knowing that there is nuance beyond this. But when a person who's suicidal or a person with an eating disorder is hospitalized, who's been self-harming, when they go into the hospital, there is no psychiatrist that says they have a right to self-harm. They have a right to self-injure. One of the first things psychiatrists do is remove their shoelaces, remove their sharps. They know that they have a duty to do no harm, to protect this individual from harming themselves. And yet in this situation, somehow it's controversial to say that actually we have a duty not to listen in this moment. I don't know any psychiatrist that when a person says, I don't feel my life is worth living anymore, is okay with helping them commit suicide in another way. So why is it different in medical clothing? Why is it different with lethal medications? And that contradiction we need to grapple with.
Yeah. And this was my thing that I said to my partner earlier, was if someone, I assume, you know, was struggling with depression and then they attempted suicide, they wouldn't be put on, like, you know, they wouldn't be provided assisted dying. They would be provided with one-to-one support to ensure that that's not something that happens. Why is it different for an eating disorder?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And again, I know we can think of the extreme cases. Read these cases.
Yeah.
That's the conversation we're having. We're looking at what's happened in real life with real people in real countries. And that's where these questions are coming from. They're not theoretical. They're about real humans.
There's like a whole another like piece to it. So, and I know the idea that that I am experiencing like unbearable suffering. So that ends up being one of the reasons that when we're not talking about in the jurisdictions where there isn't the terminal illness criteria, there's this notion of I'm very sick, I have a poor prognosis, or there's no chance of recovery. And in that, the suffering is unbearable, that my day-to-day living is just so unbearable. And so that's the part, that's another whole concept that we don't have a way to really to assess it in any meaningful way. There in some jurisdictions, is it the Netherlands, where they're told to really like check your own gut for how that feels for you, and they have a term for it. It's
invalidbaar. Yeah. It means is the suffering palpable to the physician? Yeah.
Right. So, but there's no way to assess it, and this is also can be a target of treatment, right? So Marsha Linehan was brilliant in all of her distress tolerance work and emotion regulation work. So when I'm hearing a patient talking about my suffering is unbearable, we have a whole field, an evolving field of mindfulness and embodiment that specifically works with those variables, right? And how do I create a life that is bearable? How do I work with my own suffering? How can I learn to relate to it? But instead, it's used for a justification for assisted death, when I don't think we really understand the suffering that happens in eating disorders very well. And we don't have it as a treatment target in most traditional treatments. So that's a whole nother aspect of this that hasn't been well considered.
And I think, I don't know if this is me going off on a tangent or whether this is relevant. I think it's relevant. It came to my mind when you were talking. Is suffering is also subjective. Is it subjective? Is that the right word?
Yeah.
As in like, yeah. You know, I could stub my toenail and it'd be the worst pain in the whole entire world if that's the worst thing I've ever felt. But for someone else, that's literally nothing because they've been through so much more. And from my understanding of people that I've met that have had eating disorders, they are incredibly resilient and strong people. And I guess this is actually maybe the opposite of what I'm trying to say, but something to the clinician that seems like, you know, unbelievable pain and there's no way out and there's too much suffering going on to even consider recovering. How can you make that measurement? Because there's so much bias involved in that in terms of like your reflection on seeing their condition and, you know, your assumption of how much pain they're in from what they're saying to you. I don't know if I'm really making sense, but I think basically it's all just so subjective rather than, you know, there being clear guides of, you know, I think that's the thing when we've got, you know, physical illnesses that are terminal, you know that they have like a a terminal end, and you know, whether it's looking at blood markers or things like that, you might be able to make a guesstimate of how long someone's going to live. We don't have any of that with eating disorders. It is just based on somebody's personal detail of the amount of pain that they're in and their, I guess, perspective on their own recovery. But, you know, from personal experience, this time last year, I did not think I would be in the position that I am now. If you'd have said to me, you're going to be more recovered than you've ever been in the 14 years you've had anorexia, I'd be like, you're talking all this shit. Like, I don't understand how that's even going to be possible. Yet here I am. And so it's, you can't say because of this one instance, therefore this is going to happen, or because of another instance, this will happen.
Yeah. Anna, you know, what it brings up for me, we were, yesterday, a comment there's an article that's going to come out in Scotland. They're considering legalizing assisted dying, and they're doing the same thing in England and in Wales. And a journalist asked me if I could comment on the Scottish law that's being considered at the moment. And she said, it's for terminal conditions, but given your study, do you think, you know, people with eating disorders be at risk? And so, well, let me look at the law and see how it's written. And this is part of where I said I started pretty middle of the fence, but having dug into this data, it's very hard to see ways in which this is, I'm not seeing countries in which this is being done safely. The definition of terminal illness in that law is so loose that eating disorders would absolutely qualify. Like it's defined as terminal condition is defined as an incurable disorder, and I'm saying, you know, based on what we've already seen in these other countries, an incurable progressive disorder that results in premature death. That is how they define terminal illness. And so I feel like I listen with new ears to these debates because in principle, you know, when I began this, I could go, okay, I could see assisted dying for people with terminal conditions. And I can see that in principle. But in practice, that is not how things are happening. Not if the law has such a loose definition of terminal condition that anorexia fits through the door. So it's really, you know, I kind of want to shed light on it because I know it's an issue that both Catherine and I actually kind of agree. We're like, oh yeah, we could see this as being appropriate in some cases, but when these laws actually go into practice, the safeguarding measures that have been put in place in clinical practice don't work as well as they've been sold. And so that's part of why we've launched this whole campaign. We've released a joint statement signed now by over 200 organizations and physicians and clinicians urging governments to take action to make those safeguards a whole lot more rigorous and to explicitly make sure that an eating disorder is not a qualifying condition in its own right. And that requires, you know, changing laws. And on top of that, to get us some treatment.
and transparency in the cases that are being done, right? So that we can see what's going on and study it. Like, so if we can't study it, right. And the last point, and I said that too quickly, because I want to emphasize Chelsea's last point. There is currently not effective enough treatment, and there's not access to the treatment that we do have to any degree enough for the need. And that's for people who live in cities close to access to care. If you live close to it, you still don't have access. But in terms of people who are in rural areas or away from larger cities, you just simply don't have care. And a lot's been done with telehealth, but there's still not enough.
Or you end up on a waiting list in the UK for months, and your eating disorder, if not over a year, and your eating disorder becomes more severe in that time. So, you know, we have to look at this issue in the context of our current healthcare system. And I know the Netherlands gets kind of lifted up as this great healthcare system, and so it's okay to do assisted dying, but there are many people with eating disorders in the Netherlands that also struggle to get access to care, especially if they have severe eating disorders. We run a lot of programs there, so I see them. I see them come through. I think we're just more than anything calling for a great deal more caution than we're seeing right now.
Yeah. But I think that's a brilliant point that you raised, that you know, we haven't even got onto is the fact that there's not even the appropriate treatment in place for people to get them to get better. And that's not because those people aren't trying to access that treatment. That's because, unfortunately, the resources are not in place to be able to provide that treatment. So, you know, let's fix that first. Let's get into a place where our healthcare system can actually support people properly to recover before we're kind of, I guess it feels like a bit of a get out of jail free card for them, because, you know, it's like, oh, well, we don't have, you know, they've not done the effective treatment. They've not succeeded in the effective treatment. This is maybe an easier route. That's me speaking out of turn. But I think it's, yeah, it's a really important point that you make there, in that we have to have that effective treatment before we're going down such severe routes. But thank you both so much for speaking with me. I think the work that you're doing is, it's just absolutely incredible. And it's terrifying. We'll say it's absolutely terrifying. And I think I still maybe am at the point where it's not quite hit me how real it is. You know, and I think what you said, Catherine, about, you know, being like, these people are dead. Like, you know, you had to keep reminding yourself that these people have died. And I think that's something that, you know, it's easy to talk about it, but it's not so easy to actually rationalize these people aren't with us anymore, and have been, you know, not supported in the right way. So for people listening, is there anything that they can do to get involved, to support? Kind of how can people come together to help you achieve what you're trying to achieve with this?
Oh, thank you for asking that. Yes, there's definitely things you can do. The first thing you can do is, we have a joint statement that is up on the Eat, Breathe, Thrive website. It's eatbreathethrive.org. And maybe Hannah can help us link to the statement itself. And it's been endorsed by a lot of big eating disorder organizations, disability rights organizations, but we've also opened it up for individuals to express their support. So one thing you can simply do is just put your name there. And every morning I refresh that and I see mom, survivor, pastor, school food service director, which one today? So whoever you are, if you want to express your support, and what we're actually calling for is an investment in treatment, an investment in research, and much more rigorous safeguards. And until we have some of the science we've been talking about, we're asking for governments to ensure that eating disorders by themselves are not qualifying conditions for euthanasia and assisted suicide. We are also, just like Hannah has modeled for us, we're doing a series of conversations in community, because we know that we need to talk about this as a field, as professionals, as people with lived experience. So we are, if you go to their website and you listen soon, there may be an event coming up. We've got one coming up on advancing treatment for people who have had their illness for a really long time. And we're talking to some really incredible experts. We just did one on autonomy in partnership with ANAD on the nuances of autonomy and eating disorder care. And we've recorded all of them. So even if you missed them, there is a page on our website where you can go watch the replay. Catherine and I did a presentation. And then we're trying to create a conversation on social media. So we have a range of social media assets you can download, like little graphics that say treatable, not terminal. You can share your own story on social media, which is something I'm really trying to encourage people to do. If you use that hashtag, we will find it and we will share it if you'd like us to. But just to spread the word, and really, you know, as dark and as heavy and as sad and tragic as these cases are and this whole topic is, we're trying to do something positive with it. And we're trying to encourage governments to act to protect people with eating disorders, and then governments to act to invest in the treatment that we need so that all people have access to the resources they need for recovery.
Yeah. In my head, and I don't know whether this is a twisted way to look at it, but I feel like those people that have died have been given an unjust service. And so it's almost, you know, that's so unjust. Let's take those instances and do something about it so that there's not more people experiencing, you know, that unjust service as well. Because I don't think that there's a single person in the world that that should be going through this. So I guess, like you say, trying to make a positive out of it is using those experiences to make sure that it doesn't happen anymore. So yeah, I'll put all the show notes, sorry, I'll put all the details in the show notes. And yeah, I just want to say a massive thank you to you both, because it sounds, you know, the work you're doing is absolutely incredible. It sounds like you put your heart and soul into it. So make sure that, I'm sure you will, but looking after yourself as well, because it's heavy. Heavy stuff that you're doing.
Well, and I think, like, for me, I keep going back to, because I mean, this isn't my field of research, eating disorders are, and treatment is, and prevention is, but the whole idea of assisted dying was, I mean, we both had to get up to speed for this and, you know, and so it was a journey. But so I have to always be like, what's my why? And my why is, I think all of those people who have passed, even more for those who are in that moment or those moments, I want us to be like that Horton Hears a Who, like that there's someone going like, you can be okay, like you can get better, right? And that there's a voice at least partially as loud as the one saying, oh, here's assisted dying, right? That it's like to hear us. And so I don't know, I love the social media campaign and getting the word out to try to overcome some of these false understandings of eating disorders. So that's my why for those that are in that place. So thank you for having us, because you made our little who voices a little bit louder.
That's what the podcast is for. I said from the start, this podcast is about amplifying the voices that, you know, maybe aren't getting heard or what have you. You know, I just hope that it will help spread the message. So yeah, thank you both so much. And yeah, I don't know how to close it, because I'm like, I feel so like, wow, this is just so much. So I'm just gonna say, there we go, yeah. And thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Anna. Nice to meet you.
If you enjoyed listening today, you won't want to miss next week's episode, so be sure to subscribe. Eating disorders are crippling illnesses, but with the right support, they can be recovered from. We really hope you enjoyed this episode, but if you require more support right now, please look into charities such as First Steps and Beat for support, or talk to someone you trust.